So at this point, one of the yes but minds comes and says, yes, but other people's suffering doesn't affect me. So why should I work to get rid of it? You know? I mean, when somebody else gets smashed in a car accident, I'm fine. I'm walking down the street. Their suffering doesn't affect me. Why should I do anything about it? Okay? People are starving somewhere else in the world. People are starving in our own country. But their starvation is their problem. It's not my problem. Why should I do anything about it? Okay? My friend is completely miserable and crazy, but that's their problem and not my problem. So why do I need to get involved? Okay? This kind of mind. Yeah? We have this. So the answer to this is that, yes, it's true that somebody else's suffering doesn't affect us the same way it does affect them. However, their suffering is no different from our own. In other words, suffering is suffering. It doesn't really matter who it belongs to. Yeah? When we look at somebody else's suffering, that suffering so easily could be our own. It's not like different kind of suffering that only they're liable to, but I'm not liable to. And it's only because we cherish our own body that we can't bear to see it harmed. And it's only because we don't cherish other people's bodies that we feel apathetic for it, towards it. Okay? But again, this is just a really superficial discrimination that we're labeling I on this body and not I on another body. Because remember, from the other person's view, I is labeled on their body. Okay? So, our biggest obstruction in understanding this is our own grasping at I and then identifying I or the self with our own body. And so self and others, you know, this discrimination of self and others, it's not, self and others aren't two distinct categories like a chair and a table or like the color yellow and the color blue, okay? I mean, yellow can't be blue, blue can't be yellow, a chair can't be a table can't be a chair. Okay, but this discrimination of self and others isn't like that because this discrimination is made just depending on viewpoint. Okay, from this viewpoint, this is I and that's others. So this one's happiness is most important and that one's isn't. But from the other way around, you know, you say I and your happiness is more important. My happiness, it becomes you and therefore less important. So you see, the discrimination of self and others isn't this hard and fast thing like the discrimination between yellow and blue or the discrimination between chair and table. Discrimination between self and others, this label, is just dependent on where you are in the situation, just dependent on your viewpoint. And remember last time we talked about this side of the street and that side of the street? And it just depended which side of the street you're standing on, which side becomes this and which side becomes that, because all you do is cross to the other, and then that side of the street becomes this side, and this side becomes that side. It's a very dependent thing. It's not hard and fast categories. Okay? So it's only because we've identified overly strongly with this side of the thing that we feel that others' suffering is less important than our own. And that's a really, you know, it's an erroneous perception. But then this doubt isn't happy yet. It says, yes, but really other suffering doesn't harm me. Yeah, so I mean, really it doesn't harm me. So really, why should I do anything about it? And then Shantideva replies, well, then if we're only concerned with our own present happiness now and what we identify as I right now in this present moment, our present body and mind, why then should we take care to eliminate our own future sickness or our own future suffering? In other words, if we're only concerned with me in this present moment, why should we take care of what happens to our own self in the future because it isn't the same I as we're experiencing now? Okay? In other words, if we're thinking, you know, I'm just working for I, me, 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 whoever is me right now, and you're not me, so why bother about you? Well, Shantideva says, but yourself tomorrow isn't you right now, so why should you care about what happens to yourself tomorrow? Get it? Okay, if you're only concerned about your own benefit, then why do you care about what happens to yourself tomorrow? Why do you do anything for yourself tomorrow? Because tomorrow's discomforts, tomorrow's sicknesses, none of them harm you right now, so why do anything about it? You know, the self today doesn't experience the suffering of tomorrow's self. Okay? So, and in a similar way, the hand helps the foot. We've gone over this before without making a big deal out of it, okay? The hand just helps the foot. The hand doesn't say, look, this, you know, your suffering isn't my suffering, so I'm not going to help you. You know, the suffering of the foot isn't the suffering of the hand, so, you know, tough it, old foot, and pull out your own thorn, you know, I'm not going to help you. It's not my suffering, it's not my problem, don't get me involved, okay? So Shantideva is saying, you know, in both of these cases, we shouldn't help our own future suffering. We shouldn't take care of the suffering our own future self would experience. And we also, you know, the hand shouldn't take care of the foot suffering because it's not its own. Okay? But we do help, okay? The hand helps the foot and we help our own future self because we consider ourselves part of the same thing. Okay? In other words, the who I am today and who I am tomorrow, they're part of the same continuum. They aren't exactly the same, but they're part of the same continuum. And similarly, the hand and the foot aren't exactly the same, but they're part of the same collection. Okay? So that's why we tend to help them. But neither of these things are inherently existent. In other words, if we attach I onto this continuum of moments of self and grasp it as an inherently solid thing, then that's a mistaken notion on our part because this continuum is only a bunch of moments of self, okay? And we associate tomorrow's suffering and the day after tomorrow's suffering, you know, or the self that experiences tomorrow's suffering and the day after tomorrow's suffering and the self that experiences today's suffering, we associate them simply because they're members of, they're all moments of the same continuum. But that continuum isn't one solid, inherent, independent unit. It's just a collection of parts of different moments. Okay? So anything that's a continuum isn't a solid thing, it's just a collection of parts. Like an hour. An hour isn't one solid thing, it's just a collection of minutes, it's a collection of seconds. So similarly, the self now, the self tomorrow, the self in 5 years, we take care of them all, but none of them are inherently existent. It's just a dependent continuum upon which we label a merely labeled I, there's no inherent I in any of that. Okay? And in the same way, that's looking at it from the point of view of continuum, from the point of view of collection, okay, the hand and the foot are part of the same collection, and on top of all these different parts of the body and mind, we label I, but again, that collection isn't a solid, independent, single collection. The collection is simply a group of different parts. So, you know, to make the I that's labeled on top of that collection too solid is also a misperception. Okay? So what we're doing is we're trying to chip away at the solidity of the I because it's by making the I very, very solid that we feel this is me independent here and that's you and so your problem is your problem. My problem is mine and mine is most important. Okay? So you see what we're trying to do by this way of thinking is chip away at how we view the I as a really solid thing. Okay? So we're really integrating here the teachings on emptiness into the development of bodhicitta, which is why this method becomes very, very profound. Okay. Okay, so there's no independent suffering. There's no independent I, which is the possessor of the suffering. Okay, there's no independent I which owns the suffering. So what are we getting so hung up about? And how can we vouch that my suffering is more important than anybody else's if there's no independent person that is possessing that? If the person that's possessed, you know, that is experiencing that suffering is something that exists just by being merely labeled on top of that collection or on top of that continuum of moments. How can we hold on so strongly to that I and the position of that I if it's something that's merely labeled? Okay. And so the suffering of self, the suffering of others, both exist by being merely labeled. Okay, both, and they're both equally exist by being merely labeled, and so they must both be equally dispelled simply because they're painful. Okay, in other words, pain is pain. It doesn't matter, you know, since there's no solid person that's possessing the pain, then it doesn't matter whose pain it is. It's pain to be eliminated. Okay? It doesn't matter whose happiness it is, it's happiness to be developed. Because there's no independent I there that, you know, is going to cling on to this happiness anyway. It's just something that's merely labeled. Both the happiness and the I or the self, who's the possessor of the happiness, all exists by being merely labeled. And so then the doubting mind says, yes, but it's really too much of a burden to cherish others more than myself. And I have enough suffering already. Why should I get involved in others? Yeah? And the answer to that is that when we develop the compassion that cherishes others more than self, that compassion actually serves to protect ourselves from suffering. So in other words, it doesn't become a burden to take care of others and work for their happiness and work to eliminate their suffering, because when you do it with the mind of love and compassion, you do it with a happy, joyful mind. And so it doesn't become suffering for you. It's not like you're taking on more burden or more suffering than you have already. You're doing it with a joyful mind, so actually your mind is happier than before. And see, this is what makes the big difference between caring for other people in a codependent, dysfunctional way and caring for people in a bodhisattva way. Okay? Because when we care for people in this sticky, gooey codependence thing, although it seems ostensibly that, oh, I'm working so hard for the benefit of others, really, when you look deeper, one is working for one's own benefit. It's like, I get something out of this relationship, so I'm going to perpetuate it. And the way I perpetuate it is by doing all these things that look like I'm taking care of others, but it's basically because I'm trying to protect my own interests. And I'm not really taking care of others because I really care about them. I'm doing it basically because I feel guilty, I feel obliged, I feel afraid of what's going to happen if I don't do this. Okay, so that's what's going on when it's an unhealthy thing that is seemingly taking care of others but isn't really. And I think this is where a lot of the recovery movement has gone slightly askew, is that they get everybody saying, I've taken care of others my whole life, now I'm going to take care of myself. When the actual fact is they haven't taken really care of others their whole life, because there's been a lot of expectations and impure motivations in that whole thing. And so all they're really doing now is exchanging one selfish motivation for another one. Okay, and neither of those things free the mind from the pain. Okay? Because whenever you get into this thing of, I'm taking care of myself because I'm tired of taking care of others, I'm tired of sacrificing for them my whole life, you know, there's so much anger in that, that how can one possibly be happy? And this whole thing of setting limits and setting boundaries, you know, in the recovery movement, it's often, I'm setting a limit, I'm setting a boundary, you can't do this. And as soon as you start seeing setting boundaries as telling people what they can't do, then you get into this really solid me versus them position, and it just produces a lot of pain and discomfort because you get so defensive about somebody's walking on my territory, somebody's on my thing, on my turf. I have to stand up for myself. I have to put them in their place. Okay? And it develops all this hostility. So I do believe in setting limits and boundaries, but in my view, setting limits and boundaries is not a question of telling other people what they can and can't do, because we can't control what other people do, can we? No possible way. You know, we can tell other people what they can and can't do all until we're blue in the face. That doesn't change anything. They're still going to do what they want. Okay? So to me, what setting limits and setting boundaries are, it's talking to ourselves and saying, if somebody does this, this is how I'm going to respond. Okay? So we're trying to limit our own behavior, put a boundary on our own unhealthy response. We're trying to limit our own guilt, our own feeling of unhealthy obligation, our own expectations, our own ulterior motivations. And to me, that's what setting limits and setting boundaries is. Okay? It's working on the self, not working on others. Okay? So, this is the real key, you know, because when you cherish others from a bodhisattva perspective, it's not done out of guilt, obligation, shoulds, ulterior motivations, getting something out of it oneself. It's done just because others, because suffering is suffering, it doesn't matter whose it is, and happiness is happiness, it doesn't matter whose it is. And so there's no strong I in this whole thing. Okay, so because there's no strong I, there's not going to be a lot of suffering. And because one's compassion and love for others is very genuine, then we're going to do that with a happy mind. And so taking care of others isn't a form of sacrificing so that I'm miserable. Okay. And in our Western culture, we often think that taking care of others means I have to be miserable. In other words, I'm not really taking care of others unless I'm really suffering. Okay, we get in the whole martyr syndrome. You know, from a bodhisattva way, the spirit of taking care of others is done with tremendous joy. So although we say we take the burden on of caring for others, the assumption of the burden is done with incredible joy. You know, and you can see, like, just you can get an inkling of how this is possible when you think about how sometimes there's been people that you really, really care about, and how you will go out of your way and do things that are very inconvenient for you or even sometimes physically painful for you, but you don't really mind it, you don't think of it because your attention's so much focused on wanting them to be happy. Huh? I mean, once in a blue moon, this actually happens. And you, I think this is why the example of the mother is used so often, you know, because the mother, especially the pain of the childbirth and, you know, the sacrifice, but it's done so happily, so joyfully for the infant. You know, there's not a feeling of you know, oh, look what I did, kind of, you know, it's a real happy kind of thing. And we do it too, or, you know, when we really care deeply about other people. And so just the fact that we can do it with one or two people means that it's possible actually to do it with everybody. We just have to become familiar with it and develop that kind of attitude. Okay, so then the doubting mind says, yes, but how can I think of another's body as my own? And how can I think of somebody else's suffering as my own? How is that possible? You know, you're telling me to help others the same way I help myself just because considering their problems and sufferings and happiness as worthwhile as my own. How can I do that? How can others, I consider others' body my own? And to this, Shantideva has an answer that to me is like, this to me is like so profound. Shantideva says, well, look at your own body. You know, we hang on to this body and identify with it so strongly. This is me. But what is it? This body belongs to our parents. Yeah, it's not our body. It came from the sperm and egg of our parents. It's not ours. Yeah, and when you think of how this body arose, it's two other people's bodies coming together. It's not our body. Yeah, the sperm and the egg didn't belong to us. When they came together and all the genetic subdivision that happened after that, why should we grasp so strongly onto I? You know, as that being I, when in fact it's the body of other people. It is, but it's a wrong basis, isn't it? Yeah? Okay? And, you know, I mean, it's real interesting to sit and contemplate this sometime and just really think of your own body and how it really is your parents' body. You know, half the genes from your dad, half the genes from your mom, all the other atoms and molecules from, you know, all the muesli and milk and oranges and broccoli, you know, and whatever else you ate your whole life. So how is this body me? Or how is this body mine? It really isn't. When you really sit there and examine, it belongs to other sentient beings. It's very, very clear. You know, genetically it belongs to others, and the material that which is composed, all the food we ate, belongs to others. You know? All that food, all the broccoli and cauliflower and cheese and pizza, yogurt, chocolate cake, you know, all of those didn't belong to me. They all belonged to others. Other people gave those things to me and I ate them. So the whole thing, you know, and it's really weird when you think about it because we identify so much I with this body. And when you examine it with your reasonable, rational mind, there's absolutely no basis to identify I with this body. You know? It falls apart. It becomes like air. Okay? So if the reason for identifying so strongly I with this body can't hold water, then it becomes, and we see that this whole identification happened simply because of familiarity, then we can begin to see that it's equally possible that we familiarize this concept of I with other people's bodies. And we can familiarize the concept of I wanting happiness with other people instead of with this one. Yeah? It's just a matter of habit, just a matter of familiarization. It's really quite amazing when you think about it. And so then the mind says, when we start, you know, really talking about exchanging self and others, then the doubting mind says, yes, it would be good to exchange myself and others, but it's too hard to do. And Shantideva replies, actually, it just depends on familiarity. Okay? It just depends on familiarity. And he gives the example, and he says, there might have been somebody before who we hated with a passion. And then the relationship changed, and now we love that person with a passion. And that whole incredible change of feelings came about simply because of familiarity. Simply due to concept and familiarity. You can change the intense hatred into intense love. So he says, if you can do that by the power of familiarity, then what you identify as I and others can equally be changed by the power of familiarity. You know? So that when we say I, or when we say, you know, what is most important, instead of attaching it to this body and mind, it becomes attached to others' bodies and minds. And it actually makes much more sense, doesn't it? Because there's only one here and infinite there. So if we're really going to be democratic about who deserves happiness and suffering, and we're all good Americans and want to be democratic, don't we? Then it really makes sense to take care of others' problems and others' welfare, because there's more of them than us, and to associate where the importance belongs with others.